This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Neil Conan. During the Second World War, the U.S. Army Air Force and Consolidated Aircraft called their B-24 bomber the Liberator. Aircrew tended to call it the spam can in the sky, the old agony wagon, or the flying brick. The B-24 was ungainly and difficult to fly, but it was arguably the best bomber in Europe, with more speed, a bigger payload, and greater range than its more famous cousin, the B-17. The men who flew these planes endured temperatures of 40 and 50 degrees below zero. Most had incredibly cramped and uncomfortable places to work, except for the waist gunners, who stood in the open doorways in the wind. The plane wasn't pressurized, so the men wore oxygen masks for most of their 8 to 10 hour missions, masks that often froze to their faces. And all of that was before they encountered German fighters and anti-aircraft guns. The prolific historian Stephen Ambrose tells the story of those men in a new book called The Wild Blue, The Men and Boys Who Flew the B-24s Over Germany. Stephen Ambrose joins us from New York City. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Neil. It's very nice to be with you.
After Pearl Harbor, the Army suddenly needed thousands of pilots and tens of thousands of crew members to fly these B-24s. They had to go find them and train them and supply them. This in a country where only a tiny minority of the population ever was a passenger in an airplane, much less a pilot or a mechanic. Where did these men come from?
From all over America, from every possible profession. Most of them were just out of high school or freshmen or sophomores in college. Most of them were teenagers, but they came from everywhere. These guys had been kids when Charles Lindbergh in 1927 flew over the Atlantic, and they all wanted to fly. Many of them had never even seen an airplane, much less ridden in one, but they wanted to fly. And they flocked into the Army Air Forces, which jumped from 20,000 total in 1941 to 2.5 million by 1945. The Army Air Forces had to train all of these guys. They wanted to be fighter pilots, but the preferences that they had counted for naught with the Army Air Forces. Many of them washed out of pilot training because their eyesight wasn't good enough or their depth perception or what they weren't coordinated enough or whatever. They still wanted to fly, and these are the men who became the radio operators, the navigators, the tail gunner, the ball turret gunner, the waist gunners, everything, just so they could fly. And they did. The Army Air Forces in the Second World War were then and are still today the world's biggest educational institution. And it's an amazing thing to think about. How do you go from 20,000 to 2.5 million in a couple of years? And how do you train all of these guys? Well, the Army Air Forces did it.
You tell this story mostly through the experiences of one pilot and his crew. And the pilot is George McGovern, or I guess I should say Ambassador McGovern, the former U.S. Senator, the Democratic Party's presidential candidate in 1972. Why did you pick George McGovern?
I had been with McGovern in Austria at Innsbruck in 1988 when he was asked to participate in a television documentary that the Austrians were producing because he had been a bomber pilot. And he was reluctant, but he accepted finally and went to do the interview. And it was a woman who was sitting at the desk, and she said, "Now, Senator McGovern, you're world famous for your opposition to war, and especially to the bombing in Vietnam. Yet you were a bomber pilot in World War II. You destroyed our beautiful cities. You killed our women and children. Don't you regret that?" And George said, "No, I don't regret it at all. I wanted to liberate your country, Austria, and Europe from Hitler. And I wanted to do my part, and so I was a bomber pilot. No, I don't regret it at all." Well, she was very distressed to hear that and disappointed. And McGovern then added, "There is one bomb that I do think about quite a lot and I regret a lot." And she, "What was that?" She said, "What was that?" Well, he was flying back from a mission over Vienna back to his base in Italy. And the crew called up, "Skipper, we got a bomb, the last bomb, stuck in the bomb bay door, half in and half out of this airplane.
This is a 500-pound bomb.
500-pound bomb. And George immediately said, well, we can't land with the bomb sticking out of the bomb bay. You got to either get that thing out of there, drop it, or we're going to all have to bail out when we get over Italy.
And nobody wanted to bail out.
Nobody wanted to bail out. So a couple of the navigator and the radio man went to work on that bomb, and they finally got it free and dry. Now, by this time, McGovern was down about 10,000 feet above the ground, and it was a clear day, and they could watch the bomb go. It hit a farm and just blew it to smithereens, the house and the barn, big fire and so on. And George looked at his watch. It was high noon, and he said, oh, he came from South Dakota. He knows what time farmers eat lunch. And he thought, oh, Lordy, this is a peaceful little farm. It's not bothering anybody, and I've just killed some people. And, oh, he just felt terrible. And he thought about that a lot over the years between the war. And this happened in 1945 and 1988 when he's on the Austrian TV. Cut. And then a couple of weeks or months later, whenever, they showed it on the television in Austria. And the station got a call from a farmer who said, it was my farm. I know exactly when it happened. I know it was a single bomber up there. And I want you to tell Senator McGovern, nobody got killed. We saw that bomb and we got into the air raid shelter, he and his wife and his two daughters, and nobody got killed. So please tell Senator McGovern that. Okay, we will. And then he said, but one other thing I want you to tell him. I don't care what other Austrians say today. I hated Hitler. And my thought as I watched my farm go up in smoke was, if this shortens the war by 1 minute, it's worth it. Well, the station called George and gave him that message. And as George says today, it just wiped the slate clean. Well, that story has always stuck with me. And then a couple of years ago, I was having dinner with George, and he said that a reporter had been interviewing him and wanted to do a book on his career in the Second World War. 35 missions he flew, mm-hmm. Got a Distinguished Flying Cross. And I said, great, tell the reporter to start with that story of that bomb stuck in the bomb bay door. And George looked at me and said, I wish you were writing it. And I said, well, George, I would love to do that, but this other guy's already gotten started. George said, I'll talk to him. And he did, and I got the assignment, and so I did this book.
That's a great story. In a lot of war memoirs, and I guess a fair number of histories too, the training and the industrial element, the design, the manufacture, those sorts of issues are almost brushed aside, a little like the way a Hall of Fame baseball player writes off his time in the minor leagues. Mm. This makes up about half of your book, though. Why did you focus so much on that part of it?
Well, because it is so important. You can't send guys out to fight who haven't been trained. And you can't send them out to fight if they don't have the weapons to fight with. So I wanted to account for the training, what it was, how it happened for George and for the other pilots, and how that bomber was made. They made 18,300 B-24s. That was 5,000 more than there were B-17s. One of the interviewees told me, he said, we came out of the cloud, we looked around, and we were forming up, and there were B-24s all over the sky. And I thought to myself, Rosie the Riveter is doing a great job. The B-17 is far more famous than the B-24. Almost nobody remembers the B-24 unless they happen to be a pilot or a crew. The B-17 got great coverage because Flying Fortress, it was called, it flew out of England. And all the top reporters, Walter Cronkite was one. Andy Rooney was another. And they wanted to be in London. They didn't want to be stuck at some little village in Italy. And so the 8th Air Force got all the glory. The 15th Air Force suffered the highest losses. The B-24s first came into existence. The first model was flown in 1939. In 1945, they all came home to be, they were made out of aluminum, to be squashed by bulldozers because the United States needed aluminum. As a result, there is only one B-24 still in existence today.
And you got to fly it.
And I got to fly it, yeah. That's not really correct to say. I was a co-pilot, and I had the controls for a while, but it was a calm day over Pennsylvania, a few clouds. Nobody was shooting at the plane. There wasn't any flak, and so I didn't really fly it, but I did have the controls for a while.
Did it make you appreciate what those pilots had to do a little bit more, though?
Oh, very much so, because there's no hydraulics in the thing, and everything has to be done by muscle power, and the seat is so cramped, there's no room to stretch, and you're sitting there, they were, for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 hours. There was no place to relieve yourself. And flying that plane is very, very slow to respond to any kind of raise or lower flaps or turn it a bit, and it's very slow to respond and takes an... It's like it used to be. People my age and older will remember this. It's like driving a big old truck in the 1940s, before power steering, before air conditioning in the vehicle. And that's what flying a B-24 was like.
All of this training that McGovern and his cohort went through, did it prepare them for combat?
Yes. More than 300 hours in the air before they went into combat. As compared to the Germans, they were lucky if they had 3 hours in the air. The Brits had about 30 hours in the air. The Japanese, the Zero and the Betty pilots for the Japanese had 2, 3 hours in the air.
This was toward the end of the war.
Towards the end of the war. But McGovern and his fellow pilots of the 741st Bombing Squadron, 300 to 350 hours of training in the air, plus all the training on the ground that they went through, and it made them proficient.
So they started out in small planes, two-seaters, and then
that's right.
Graduated.
Single-engine, two-seaters with no canopy.
And then
that's,
graduated.
And they graduated flying four-engine bombers.
And each one of those steps is, you know, I couldn't believe how hard it was.
Yeah. Oh, sure, of course. Yeah, very much so. But it was a mark of how good their instructors were. The instructors initially were civilian pilots, but very quickly the Army Air Forces started moving its own men in to those positions. And by the time McGovern was into his training in 43 and 44, they were coming back from Europe. They had done their 25 missions, and they were veterans. And that was a way in which the Americans did so much better than the Germans. When the Germans had a good pilot, and they did. Initially in the war, they had the best pilots in the world. But the Germans always kept their aces up in the air, and they stayed up there. They weren't pulled out to become instructors. They stayed up in the air until they were shot down. And by the end of the war, they were just all gone. And meanwhile, what few pilots the Germans were able to train had been trained by men that didn't know what the hell they were talking about. And they had maybe 3 or 4 hours in the air.
My guest is historian Stephen Ambrose. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with Stephen Ambrose. His new book is The Wild Blue, A History of the Men and Boys That Flew the B-24s Over Germany. George McGovern and his crew arrive in Italy in the fall of 1944 to join the 15th Air Force, which is flying from bases in southern Italy. Is it fair to say that the veteran crews they met when they landed were confused or dispirited about the purpose of a strategic bombing campaign that didn't seem to be having much of an effect and was taking this terrible toll on them and their friends?
They weren't dispirited, but they were exhausted and terribly shaken by flying through that flak and seeing their buddies go down and taking hits on their own plane. And they did wonder, not so much what's the purpose of all this. They were told in the briefing every morning, the reason we're hitting Munich today is we're going to go after the oil refineries, or we're going after a factory system, or we're going after the railroad marshaling yards because the Germans are moving troops from the Eastern Front to the Western Front, and they're going through Munich, or whatever other the target was. They were told why they were doing it. And then in the debriefing, they were told what the results were, how many of the bombs fell within the target area, And so they were kept up with details on why they were doing what they were doing and what the results of it were. But they were so exhausted and they were so badly battered by the German anti-aircraft, the FLAC, at that time. Mm-hmm. And they, is this war ever going to have an end? They did have the hope of going home while the war was on. This is very unlike the infantry, where they knew in the infantry, we're here until the Germans surrender, period.
For the duration.
For the duration. The airmen, at first it was 25 missions and you can go home. And then that was raised to 35 missions, which was the figure that McGovern and his fellow pilots and crews operated under. Oh, boy, when they got up to that 34th mission and then to the 35th mission, and oh, it's like dying on the last day of the war. That shook them a lot. But at least there was an end in view if you were in the Army Air Forces. And that helped to keep these guys going. And they, of course, they knew that the Germans are being pressed on the east, and the Russians are now into eastern Germany, and the Americans are into western Germany, and France has been liberated, and so on. They knew all of that. But they were still getting shot badly on the raids over Munich or Linz or Vienna or Berlin or wherever, because the Germans were pulling all of their artillery back, not to use it on the front lines, but to defend their cities. They wanted to make the price so high that the Americans would call off the bombing raids. Well, they came close, but they never did achieve that.
Joseph Heller later based his great book, Catch-22, on his experiences as a bomber pilot. He flew with the 12th Air Force out of North Africa that was later transferred and became part of the 15th Air Force. But I wonder, do you think he caught the spirit of that period right in his book, the fundamental idea that, well, you had to be crazy to fly in these missions, but if you went and told the flight surgeon, the doctor, that, well, you were crazy and you can't fly, that meant you were sane, and of course, that meant you had to fly. Catch-22.
Well, there's a story about that. I was with Joe on the 50th anniversary of VE Day, and he looked at me and he said, you know, I never had a bad officer. I was astonished. I said, Joe, how can you say that? You're the man who invented Major, 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 Colonel Cathcart, General Drudel,
Milo Minderbender.
That's right. You're the man who created all these people. He said, they're all inventions, every one of them. On the, you got to be crazy to fly these missions, but if you ask to be relieved, then you're not crazy anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the Army Air Forces never made a man fly. With no questions asked, if you said after the briefing, I'm not going to go on this one, you didn't go. That applied to the pilots, to the co-pilots, to the gunners, to the radio man, to the navigators. Everybody could just opt out by just saying, I'm not going to do that. They never did. I don't know of one instance in which a man did that in the Second World War.
Like all rookies, though, I wonder that McGovern crew, you describe them sort of looking at the thousand-yard stares of the veterans and wondering, you know, these guys who are the same age they are, these are young men, as you point out, you know, kids that you'd think twice about handing the car keys to in the 21st
yep.
century.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, they look like old men after 10 missions or so.
Oh, yes, very much so. Haggard and that thousand-yard stare and the weight of their responsibilities, whatever it was that they were doing in that plane, they had big responsibilities, and it aged them or it matured them or both is what happened. And they developed a closeness in those planes. The engineer and the navigator and the radio man and the two pilots were all officers. The gunners were all sergeants, and in the infantry, officers and enlisted men were told, don't ever, ever get close to one another.
Hmm.
Well, some of them did, of course, but don't ever drink together or go out together. In the Army Air Forces, it was entirely different. This was not George S. Patton's martinet kind of approach to how to make war.
No, no, spit
and the
and
Army
polish.
Air Forces, yeah, spit and polish. The Army Air Forces, those guys were hanging around in sweatshirts. one of them, a man named Higgins, wore cowboy boots on missions. And they did a lot of socializing together. They developed a comradeship, a friendship that is, for those of us who have never been in combat, just incomprehensible. And we have never been able to achieve it, and I don't know how we ever will, because when you were up in that plane, your life depended on the pilot knowing what he was doing, the co-pilot knowing, the navigator knowing, the radio man knowing, the gunners at their guns. Your life was in their hands, and their lives were in your hands. And that really does develop a closeness.
We'll continue our conversation with historian Stephen Ambrose in the second half of the show. His new book is The Wild Blue, The Men and Boys Who Flew the B-24s Over Germany in World War II. I'm Neil Conan. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Neil Conan. Let's continue our conversation with Stephen Ambrose. His new book, The Wild Blue, tells the story of B-24s and the men and boys who flew these heavy bombers in the Second World War. It focuses on the experiences of one crew and its pilot, George McGovern, who was later elected to the United States Senate and ran for president in 1972. McGovern's crew got its first taste of real combat on their second mission, and it's something you describe in your book. And I was wondering if you could read us an excerpt. It's about their second mission together as a crew, and they're flying to a target in Austria called Linz.
Hitler's birthplace. It was at Linz, on this, their second mission, that McGovern said, "We got introduced to combat. The flak was heavy." Up to that point, McGovern had thought that exploding flak looked like firecrackers and rockets going off. He learned better when a big slug of flak came right through the windshield, high into my right. It hit just above my right shoulder and to the right of my head and then fell down onto the floor between Rounds and me. Rounds was his co-pilot. McGovern and Rounds looked down at it. Rounds looked over to McGovern and just shook his head. McGovern did the same. The shrapnel was, McGovern later said, the angriest-looking piece of metal, just jagged on every edge and big enough to tear your head off if it hit a few inches to the left or maybe a few more inches on Bill Round's side. It was freezing at 25,000 feet, 50 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, in the cold rush of wind. Despite all the sheepskin-lined jackets and pants they had on, despite their electrically heated suits, it was just ferocious, that cold rush of wind. McGovern managed to keep his plane in formation, but barely. All I could do was just sit there and do my job, he said.
There must have been an awful feeling of lack of control when you're up there being fired at by cannon 88s, those famous German guns from the ground. There's no way to dodge. There's nowhere to hide.
The Germans developed a system in which they would shoot up to the altitude the planes were coming in on, 20,000, 22,000, whatever, and they would shoot up and create a box of exploding shells, all of them sending out shrapnel that could kill it as much as 50 feet or even more away. And they would have a box that would be 2,000 feet or more wide, 2,000 or more feet deep, and it just looked like, and this is the words of the pilots, it just looked like hell up there. And the idea of flying into that terrified everybody. But if you were going to drop your bombs where you were supposed to, you had to fly into that flak. And they did. And many of them got shot down, and damn near all of them got shot up to some extent or another. McGovern once brought back a B-24 that had 150 holes in it caused by shrapnel. He told me when I was interviewing him on this book, I don't know yet to this day how that plane managed to stay up in the air.
By that time, as you've pointed out, the flak, the anti-aircraft fire, was much more of a threat. The German Air Force was pretty much grounded, partly because it was so low on fuel due to the efforts of the 15th Air Force in no small part, and partly because the American bombers were well defended. There was one mission in particular towards the end of the war, though, where I want you to describe it. It was when the Germans introduced their jet fighters, the ME-262, that posed such a threat.
Yes, it did indeed. It was the best plane of the Second World War. Thank God there weren't very many of them, and thank goodness they didn't have any gasoline to run them with. It could have turned the war, but it didn't. The Tuskegee Airmen, these were African-American pilots. Many of them were Tuskegee graduates, and they flew P-51s as cover for the B-24s or the B-17s. And they stayed up above the bombers, so they're really up there, 30,000, 32,000, 35,000 feet. But they could come down. You could pick up speed awfully fast when you're going down in a P-51. That P-51 was a long-range fighter, and when it was introduced in late 1944, it made a tremendous difference and was a great airplane. One of the Tuskegee Airmen told me in an interview, he said, listen, that plane was such a sweetheart. If it had been a girl, I would have married it. Well, McGovern looked behind, and here comes a couple of German jets. And where the hell are those? Where are those black guys? Where the hell are they? God almighty. And son.
Excuse me. Did the pilots use the word black guys?
No, they used a word that we're not allowed to use on the radio anymore. and one of the Tuskegee Airmen called down to George on the radio. He said, "Would you white boys just shut up? We're going to get you home." And they came down and they drove those German ME-262s away from the formation. And so they did get to make it back to base all right, McGovern and his crew and the others in the squadron. I've always loved that. "Would you white boys just shut up? We're going to get you home."
Stephen Ambrose, a lot of people must wonder, you never served in the U.S. military yourself.
No, I did not. There's a explanation. I was born in January of 1936. Now, every man alive from the beginning of time always has a question in his mind. Am I a coward? And the only way you're ever going to find out is to go into combat. But most men are born at a time that they're never going to see combat. I was too young for World War II. I graduated high school in 1953, and I was going to join the Marines, but Eisenhower shut down the Korean War, so I went to college instead. And by the time of Vietnam, I had five kids, and I was much too old. That's the experience of most men. That is, if you were born in 1920, for certain, you were going to be in the Second World War, whether you were Japanese or German or Russian or American or whatever. If you were born in the year 1900, you were for certain in Europe going to be in the First World War. But if you were born after the Vietnam War, or if your birthday, your 10th birthday was 1973, almost for certain you are never going to find the answer to that quintessential question, am I a coward? I don't know if I'm a coward or not. I've never been confronted with it. I never was in combat. Right.
Why did you get so interested in writing about it? You've written, I'm not going to tote them up, but you know, a bunch of many of the best books about World War II.
I got into it because I was a historian trained at the University of Wisconsin, and it seemed to me then, and does now, that war is always decisive. We live today in the richest and freest country that ever was. How did that happen? Well, I'll tell you why. Because we defeated the totalitarians. We put Hitler into the ash can of history where he belongs. Also Tojo, also Mussolini, also the Soviet Union's leaders. The triumph of democracy means everything to all of us around the world. And this was decided not because there was a popular vote and the majority of the world's people said we go for democracy, not totalitarianism. It happened because we won the wars. And what I want to know and have devoted a largest part of my career to is find out, how did we do that? How did we create the Army Air Forces of the Second World War? How do we create that vast Navy? At the beginning of World War II, for example, our armed forces ranked 16th in the world, right behind Romania. By 1945, we had the biggest and best Navy ever, the biggest and best Air Force ever, an army that was smaller in size to the Russian army, but an army that had more firepower than any other in the world. Now, how in the hell? And then we had the men that would go out and do what had to be done. Now, how was that accomplished? That's my question. Mm. And that's what I've devoted my life to trying to answer.
My guest is historian Stephen Ambrose. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's continue now with historian Stephen Ambrose. His new book is The Wild Blue. You started as an historian. One of your great early projects was you started actually writing about Dwight D. Eisenhower as a soldier and then went on to continue the biography in his years as president.
Yes, and that got me into political history, which I wouldn't have done otherwise, but it's Eisenhower's fault. He's the one who ran for president, and I wanted to write his full biography. So I spent a lot of time doing that. Then when I had finished, I did a book called Pegasus Bridge, but on a British airborne company.
And I remember I interviewed you after that book.
Yes, I remember very well.
I remember one of the things that you told me was how much fun it was and what a relief it was, in a way, after this enormous research project, all living these many years on the life of one man, to come down and do a small unit, single battle.
Absolutely. It was. And I then did Dick Nixon. I spent a decade of my life writing three volumes about Richard Nixon with an awful lot of research and interviews and so on.
Why?
And then my editor, Alice Mayhew, called and said, Steve, we want you to do Nixon next. And I said, Alice, I never even liked the guy. I don't want to spend the time that a biographer has to spend with his subject with a man that I don't even like. She caught me by saying, where else could you find a greater challenge? And that hooked me. And there went 10 years of my life. Well, anyway, I completed the Nixon book, and then I did another airborne company, Company E, of the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne, an American unit, of course, and followed them through from their organization, they all volunteered for it, their training, over to England, then their experiences on D-Day, and then in the campaign that followed, Carentan, and then on to the drop into Holland, and then the Battle of the Bulge, and then crossing the Rhine. And they ended up, they were the outfit that took Hitler's Eagle's Nest.
And that book, Band of Brothers, is now being made into an HBO miniseries that I think starts this fall.
That's right. It starts in September.
You've written other books about other periods in history, and I think a lot of people remember Undaunted Courage, the story of the Lewis and Clark expedition. But I wanted to ask you, there was a couple of years ago where you had rather a bad accident, and for a while it was touch and go.
Yes, that's right. I fainted and fell on a marble floor and cracked my head badly for almost half a year, maybe even a little more than that. I couldn't see out of my left eye. I couldn't remember a damn thing. I couldn't remember my address. I couldn't remember a telephone number. Nothing. But I did find that I could remember what happened to me when I was a kid. So I figured the way out of this, and my brain wasn't functioning all that well, but anyway, my thought was, my way out of this, I'm going to write a book on friendship. And I started off with my brothers, and then talked about the guys that I went to high school with, and then my friends from college, and then my friends from my first teaching job. And all that came back to me without any problem whatsoever. And very gradually, I began to learn my phone number and remember my address. And the recovery was total, so.
After total recovery, I wonder, did you sit down and say, look, I've been granted some extra time here. What do I want to do?
No, I always knew what I wanted to do. What I wanted to do was write, and I wanted to write about things that interested me. The thing that drives me as a writer is curiosity. I want to know, how did Dwight Eisenhower rise from a man that, had he died in 1941 when he was 51 years old, nobody would have ever heard his name? How did he rise from that to be the Supreme Commander and our leader in war and in peace? Or how did the men who jumped out of airplanes, you talk about crazy, these guys jump out of perfectly good airplanes. How did they do that, and with what effect? I'm now working on a book on the Marines in the Pacific, and it's the same curiosity that drives me. How in God's name did they do that? Iwo Jima, Guadalcanal, Okinawa, and the others. So my curiosity drives me, and I never have considered doing anything else than satisfying that curiosity. And that means the only way I can really find, I did a book on the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, for example, and my question there was the same. How did they do that? How, from between 1863 and 1869, in that short space of time, did they do something that had never been done before, build a railroad across the continent? Well, I can only find the answer to that question by writing about it. The research is what I learned from, and then also the writing. And I'll think, geez, what does the reader need to know next to be able to follow this story? Or I'm doing a little repetition here, I got to cut that out, or whatever. But I learn from the act of writing. And that's what I've always wanted to do, is learn.
We're speaking with Stephen Ambrose. His new book is The Wild Blue, A History of the Men and Boys Who Flew the B-24s Over Germany. And I wanted to emphasize that one point that you mentioned. It's not the men who flew the B-24s. It's the men and the boys. And you also point out that toward the end of the war, when the crew you write mostly about, George McGovern and his men, were flying over Austria and Germany, the men who were fighting against them, well, they weren't men either. They were boys, too.
That's right. One of them was Manfred Rommel, the field marshal's son. He was 14 years old. He was a gunner with an 88 shooting at these American planes. And Manfred and I have become friends, and I've often, he's mayor of Stuttgart. He's not anymore, but he was for a very long time. And I would take the veterans to meet, everybody wants to meet Rommel's son, of course.
Sure.
And I would take veterans to meet him. And he would, if they were Army Air Force veterans, Rommel would tell him, he said, listen, I shot at you guys, but I want to assure you I always missed. Well, he didn't always miss, but it was a good thing for him to say.
Historian Stephen Ambrose, author of The Wild Blue. We'll have more of our conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. More now with Stephen Ambrose, the author of The Wild Blue, The Men and Boys Who Flew the B-24s Over Germany in World War II. There were so many controversies associated with the strategic bombing campaign against Germany and Austria, and you raise them in your book, and this is something that has to be addressed. In retrospect, some historians say, given the amount of resources, material, all of these men who had to be trained, all of these planes that had to be built, maybe in the overall scheme of things, maybe it wasn't worth it, and particularly given the fact that some 300,000, at least, German civilians were killed.
Yes, that's right. So there's both a moral question and then the very practical one. Could that effort have been made more meaningful had it gone into more artillery for the Army or bigger divisions for the Army or whatever? My own attitude has become, after doing an awful lot of reading on this subject, that's just bull. Without the bombers, I don't know how we ever would have won the war. And what they did was they just paralyzed Germany. The marshaling yards for the railroads, the bridges, were kaput by the end of the winter of 1944-45, beginning of spring, just gone. And the oil was down to, because of the concentration on the oil refineries, was down to 1% of what it had been in April 1944.
And
that's in January of 45. So that what the Air Force strategic bombing campaign did was to paralyze the German army to the point that, even beginning in 1944, but especially in 1945, the Germans had no trucks. They had no gasoline for their tanks. They didn't even have gasoline for the Mercedes for Hitler or Goebbels or Goring or the other big shots, they were reduced to using horses. So that by 1945, thanks to the strategic bombing campaign, the German army was trying to fight a war in the 20th century with 19th century material, all of it drawn by horses. Now, that's an awful big payoff.
The price, though, was very, very high.
Yes, it was. The Army Air Forces suffered losses that sometimes on one raid over Ploiesti, for example, in Romania, a great big oil refinery, the losses were as high as 40%. Even when it was 25 missions and you can go home, your chances of getting there, that is, of successfully completing 25 missions, were less than 50%. You almost were on a suicide roll in flying in the B-17s or the B-24s. You were not going to be able, in most cases, a majority of the cases, to complete 25 missions. So the price was terribly high.
And even if you did so only in the course of watching your friends die.
That's very much the case. That's right. And it wasn't just in combat. These are young men with great big machines. What's going to happen? You're going to have accidents. And there were a lot of accidents in training. The figures on the numbers of men lost in training are very high for the Army Air Forces because you've got 19-year-old pilots. McGovern was 20 years old flying this great big four-engine bomber with a crew of 10. And accidents happen. They flew in a formation to ward off enemy fighters and to make certain that they dropped their bombs together so that they all hit on the target. They flew in a diamond formation. A squadron had 7 planes in it, wingtip to wingtip. Now, I'm not talking about doing that once in an air show. I'm talking about all the way from Italy up into Romania or up into Munich or up even into Berlin and so on, wingtip to wingtip. So you were constantly tense, watching on both sides of you that. And when I say wingtip to wingtip, they wanted to make certain that they were so close that no fighter could ever, ever go between the two planes. McGovern says that if you gave me a choice between flak and bad weather, I'd always choose the flak. He said that when you're going up into the clouds with a plane on your left and a plane on your right and a plane up ahead of you and a plane behind you and all of you damn near touching and you can't see anything. He said that was the worst.
There was one moment where that formation went into a cloud. He was flying, I think, number 2, and the guy next to him is number 3, and they came out of the cloud, and somehow those guys had reversed positions.
Yes, that's right. That's right. There are instances, and this happened with the 741st as well as with other squadrons, where a plane would be over another one and it would drop its bombs, and who would it hit? It would hit the plane right below it. That happened. So, and very often when a plane got shot up and an engine shot out and a big part of the wing shot off and it would wheel to the left and start down, it would hit the plane beside it. So there were a lot of accidents.
At the end of it all, you spent a long time speaking with George McGovern and making him remember things I'm sure he hadn't recalled for some years. At the end of it all, what does he make of the experience? What does he think it did for him?
I want to. You ask about George, and I want to read it. Ask George to sum up his war experience. With his answer, he spoke for every airman, every GI, every sailor, Marine, every Coast Guard man of World War II. Quote, piloting a B-24 in combat with 8 other guys, sometimes 9 other guys, took every ounce of physical energy I had, every bit of mental abilities I had, and literally every shred of spiritual resource that I had. I can't recall any other stage of my life, unless it was the closing days of the 72 presidential campaign, that so demanded everything I had. I gave that World War II effort everything except my life itself, and I was ready to give my life. It literally exhausted every resource of mind and body and spirit that I had. That's what the war was for George, and for, as I say, for all the others.
Stephen Ambrose, thank you very much.
Thank you, Neil. It's a great pleasure to talk to you.
Historian Stephen Ambrose. His new book is The Wild Blue, The Men and Boys Who Flew the B-24s Over Germany in World War II.